the clipboard that I gave. Okay, there. On the clipboard is what I came up with at 3:30 in the morning last night. Because I was sort of reading through the last chapter again, where I was talking about folk music and how to sort of nuance that view and see rap music. And then what I realized then was that I want to explain, sort of say, this is why they could have come under criticism, this is why they were doing sort of making a cultural faux pas, but then at the same time, it's absolutely not surprising at all. They were accepted by the rap canon, that they moved on, because they had not only talent and flow, but also that not all rap is political or has to be community building or has to mean anything.
Right.
And the and even when it does, the importance of the political rap becomes the message, not the messenger. Which is to say that if they had been black, had chosen to, as Chuck D puts it, you know, be Black America CNN, that it wouldn't matter whether or not they were middle class. It wouldn't matter whether or not they were, you know, they'd gone to private school. What would basically matter is what was being said and how they were saying it. So I want to split it up and, in the first part, talk about how, sort of say what I just said, which is to say that rap is equally valued in its flow, its ability to introduce familiar sounds in new and interesting ways, and how it sounds as much as it is for its community building use as social protest, sort of keeping a pulse on Black America, and then sort of say, you know, rappers are not stuck being cultural emissaries or spokespeople for the Black community. Rather, it can be about all these other things. So then, what I want to do is follow with an analysis of the song Sure Shot, and through Trisha Rose's definition of flow and looking elsewhere in terms of what makes rap, what makes it good on a purely sonic level, explain how this song in specific demonstrates all these things, and how it, you know, when it comes down to it, it's sort of like Wynn Marsalis, who's always saying, you know, you can argue with me for years about what the music means, but then critics will sort of slam him and they'll say, well, let's play. Let's leave it up to the music to decide. And then, so taking that methodology, taking analysis of Sure Shot and showing how that is useful as opposed to something that wasn't. And then after that, explain how that had they chosen to, and take a deeper look at Black messengers, which is to say, through a short biography of Chuck D and looking at his lyrics, say, here is authentic political Black rap, and here is you know, authentic being in quotes, and that even when it is strictly culturally meaningful, that that the important part there is what the text rather than the speaker of the text.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem useful?
Is this chapter 2?
3.
Chapter 3. So what you're doing is you're expanding. So chapter 2 is about the definition of folk and authenticity.
Right.
And then chapter 3 is on how the Beastie Boys managed to make authentic style music. Despite what seem like their external inauthenticities.
Right. The chapter 2 sort of sets up the how rap sort of has fit into the heavily guarded folk being in quotes folk culture of previous Black musics. But then chapter 3, I want to sort of spend tearing some of that down, or at least complicating it with the truth, which is the truth being that, you know, it doesn't matter your background. You don't necessarily need to be from the street to be accepted and understood. That yes, skin color definitely does matter because mm-hmm. of reasons cited before, like from the first chapter, mm-hmm. Minstrelsy and white privilege. But when it comes to it, down to it, like a acceptance has more to do with flow, and it has more to do and less to do with the social background of the mm-hmm. of the rapper. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I guess one nuance I would argue for would be, I worry when you use the term acceptance by the rap community, if it kind of makes the rap community into kind of a homogeneous thing that renders like judgments that are like singular judgments, when in fact the so-called rap community, like any so-called community, probably has divided voices. Just like I'm sure when Two Live Crew came out
right.
in the 80s, there were some rappers who said, this is junk. This is, you know, good time music, and it's misogynistic, and therefore I won't defend it. And then there are probably others who said, we must defend it because those who want to condemn Two Live Crew also want to condemn Public Enemy or whatever.
Right.
And so I think that this is something that I always want to push for. I'm speaking like I'm writing a book or something, every word. That I just like the idea of the rap community is like rendering singular judgments like with one voice.
So how do I measure?
Well, I think there are multiple voices, because I think, like, for example, I mean, I think of like Nelson George, his book The Death of Rhythm and Blues, for example, which is not about rap, it's pre-rap, it's about R&B, but it's about R&B breaking down in a way that rap does too, in the sense of turning into crossover, and he's lamenting it becoming crossover, and he says it gets watered down and diluted of its cultural specificity in order to become more commercial, for example, Michael Jackson, Thriller. And he says that's too bad, because he longs for Teddy Pendergrass and soul and so forth. And yet, I'm sure you would find people in the R&B community who thought that Michael Jackson was cool, because it was rock, it was everything, a little bit of everything, and that he didn't limit himself to merely black styles of soul or whatever. And I bet that in the case of the Beastie Boys or some other crossover success, like Will Smith, for example, or Dr. Dre, that there are some voices in the rap community that thought it was good, and there's some that thought it was bad. And I just like the idea of it being one mind, because it's not. That's a reification, you know what I mean? That's an invention. There is no such... You can't put your microphone up to the rap community. You get different voices. And that comes out in the Trisha Rose Black Noise book to some extent. You know, she's talking to the female rappers. Are they feminists? Well, they're like, no, we're not feminists, but you know, we stick up for women, though. And then she says, well, what do you think about those male rappers who talk about bitches and hoes all the time? Do you find that offensive? And they're like, well, yeah, sometimes it is. Because it reinforces, you know, bad behavior.
So how do I fix that? Because I feel as though what I want to say is talk about... I mean, certainly that there is a sort of level of... I mean, they still continue to sell records. They still... The Beastie Boys continue to be successful. They manage to stay within the rap... Again, I hate to use the word rap community, but what I mean is that they... Tribe Called Quest puts out Midnight Marauders, mm-hmm. and the cover of it, the CD, has, you know, every rapper they know in headphones. You know, everyone from, you know, people in the Wu-Tang to... them, and the Beasties are there, right there with them, right next mm-hmm. to everybody. And I mean, it's kind of funny because you can pick, you know, they're the only white faces on the disc, but they're there in the same way that that, you know, Q-Tip comes in and does a guest spot on their record, and you know, they win the 98 Video Vanguard Award, the Michael Jackson Video Vanguard Award. And it's presented
from MTV. Who cares what MTV says?
It was presented to them by Chuck D and Public Enemy. Uh-huh. And the rest of Public Enemy, you know, and Chuck D publicly gets up and says, you know, they were with us from the beginning and a lot. Now, whether or not, you know, that he was reading a teleprompter mm-hmm. or not, I think is...
Or if he was trying to make nice because of the fact that Public Enemy hasn't sold records lately.
Right.
And he doesn't want to look like some kind of old sourpuss.
So, but I think that, like, nonetheless, there's something that I'm grasping at there, which is to say that they have stuck around longer than any other white rappers. They have sold more records more than any other white rappers. They have made more. They have more friends who rap, and rap. They have more rapper friends, and they have more producer friends, and they have more ties in the rap recording industry than any other white rapper. So I understand that sort of the word acceptance is dangerous territory, because not everyone has liked them. It's not as though they've been that they're liked everywhere they go, or that everybody even thinks they're talented. But at the same time, there's something there that I'm struggling with getting.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to sound too much like a nattering negativist, but like when people talk about the so-called jazz community, and the jazz community renders judgments on things, I mean, it's an abstraction, you know? Mm-hmm. And the idea of the rap community is an abstraction. Now, there might be some things in the rap community that, like, everybody would agree with, you know, that the message was cool, or that X, Y, or Z is not cool. But I would imagine that the whole question of the Beastie Boys, because of their background in, like, party rap as compared to conscious rap, that would be something that would remain controversial, you know, for groups like Underground Resistance, for example, who don't make party rap at all. It's all conscious. They're always dropping science, you know? They're not fooling around. And I wonder about that. And I also think that it's probably a necessary bit of opportunism on the part of some rappers to say that the Beastie Boys are cool, because the Beastie Boys are so commercially successful. And that you don't want to, you know, you want to get with the winner. You know, I mean, there's a political part to it, right? You know?
Yeah, I completely understand. What I'm having difficulty with, then, is to...
Well, I want to render it... See, my point is, this is something I made last time, and it's just because I'm so much of a historian, and so the kind of questions I asked are always historical-type questions, and the historical question isn't like, you know, why the Beastie's good, or how can I prove that they're good? I'm not saying that's your point, but that would be a point for a critic. But the historical question is, like, what kind of fields of ways of talking about music, about crossover, about R&B, about the relationship between rap and rock, the relationship between rap and pop, in these whole fields of you know, talking and institutions of these different kinds of music, how did the presence of the Beastie Boys illuminate how those fields work in such a way that the point isn't, like, you know, to prove that, to say that because they were accepted by the rap community, it must mean that their music has really high quality flow, but rather, like, how does the rap community constitute itself? But I'm asking questions for a later draft, maybe. So I don't want to sound discouraging. I think you should write this.
Okay, somebody at the door.
Yeah. Maybe a quiz. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Oh, you want your bag, I guess? Okay. I think that sounds... All right.
Do you give money?
Yeah.
Oh.
Do you want to give money?
You drop class?
Yeah. I'm taking four other classes, so I can't handle it.
Okay. Here?
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, are you related to the famous Miriam Rosen?
No.
Okay.
Unless it's me.
Okay, so you don't know any other Miriam Rosen? There's a famous, I mean, you're famous too.
Yeah.
There's an art critic, or someone who writes on art, whose name is Miriam Rosen. Mm-hmm. No relation. It's okay, there's lots of followers and stuff. Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to make a comment?
I don't think you have.
Should I just say, student already has a heavy load?
Yeah.
Just so they don't keep me.
Thank you.
I was really hoping you were going to be there to Clement Greenberg and so forth.
I've read them, believe me.
Okay.
Lots of them.
Okay. Nothing to look forward to.
Well, thank you for everything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
And
I feel bad. Okay, you look worried.
It's just, I'm having trouble with this. To step out from
this
chapter for a sec, in terms of what I'm doing, in terms of what I'm writing and how I'm going about it, I'm having a lot of trouble because I sort of feel as though it's frustrating because I have these ideas and then, like, I'll for example, with the last chapter, The folk. Yes. I read a lot for that and then wrote a lot or whatever and sort of, you know, ate and slept and
right.
read that and then came back and then realized that, like, really, it was all right, but that I needed a lot,
okay.
lot more. And sort of, like, with this one, I'm having the same trouble because it's...
Okay.
Because I sort of feel like I can't...
Yeah.
I can't articulate what I'm trying to say. I guess what I mean is that, like, all of this makes a great deal of sense to me, but I always feel like almost as though what I'm trying to say is either a book or it's something which is so incredibly more complicated that I couldn't get a thesis out of it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The trying to...
Right. I'm asking too much.
It's not a question of asking too much. It's a question of... And people who write about music sort of continually have to cover every base,
right?
You know, and have to make sure that it's like, you know, trying to protect a house from the pouring rain. That everywhere you're coming, there's a new hole sprouting up in your argument.
Okay,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's difficult for me because the what I was saying last week about folk music makes a great deal of sense to me. And then, you know, everywhere I go, it's like, well, there's this new hole of. Of, you know, rappers who are actually saying socially or culturally meaningful things don't necessarily, it doesn't matter what their background is, because look at who, you know, the real guys, look at them, you know, they happen to be black, but they're just as rich, and they are, you know, they come from the same affluence.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, okay, let's deal with that. And so...
That means that there's some problem with the idea of the folk. Now, I want to say that in this thing, that I didn't see anything that... from the outline there that stuck out as intensely problematic as the idea of the folk as this organic... you know what I mean? So, but the folk thing, it does, that did stick out as a problematic term, particularly because it is... so often used as a rural term, and you're talking about such an urban music.
So it really stuck out here.
The idea of community is in no way as problematic as that.
Okay, so
I think you should write this.
If I write this and then sort of say, and do you remember there's a paragraph in chapter 2 where I said, you know, I sort of stepped back and said, I raised to note here that that when I'm talking about, you know, black music, so when I'm talking about music of black urban America, what I in no way mean to generalize or imply that, you know, all blacks are poor living in the ghetto,
right,
and
right.
blah, blah. There was a part where I sort of said, what I mean to specify is that there is a specific community or a specific group of people that that understands this as a code, and I don't even know if I had the chapter around. But the point is I think that the idea of any rap community having contradictory and multiple voices is one that I want to include, and one that I want to sort of, that's another base I want to cover, or a hole that I would like to plug with a few paragraphs.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, if you look at a group like Third Base, you know, who sort of did had a very similar gig mm-hmm. going, you know, three white rappers who were, you know, from the same kind of background and trying to do the same thing, and they just didn't have it. For whatever reason, like, they were a party band as well, I think, and they just weren't that good, and they didn't gain an acceptance as measured by support by other rappers, album sales, and you know, support from the media and MTV and so forth, that the Beasties didn't. By that's what I mean by acceptance, which isn't to say that there is one opinion which said, yes, you're okay, but I think that there is a... there is a something to be said for all of that as an approval that that others haven't got, and it's an achievement. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Part of it does.
What part doesn't?
The commercial part.
You don't see the commercial part as being indicative of anything?
It's indicative of popularity. It's not indicative of quality. I mean, because, you know, look, Will Smith sells a gazillion records, or you know, people like Shania Twain, or even worse, Jennifer Lopez as a singer. She's awful.
Are you kidding? Well, okay.
You think she's a good singer?
I don't think she's the best singer. I think that...
I mean, she's great looking and everything, obviously, for videos, but her voice is, like, thin.
I think that the style in which she's doing her music, and the instrumentation, and the her Hispanocentrism, I think is something which is unusual, and it's uh-huh. something which is to be commended. And that's what I enjoy.
Well, yeah, I'm you know,
the door.
That part I like. Uh-huh. But I'm asking, I'm telling you, thanks. So we're done?
Yeah.
Great. I'll just put this here. You may now take your bag.
Should we anticipate a quiz on Thursday?
You can anticipate. I don't know if there's going to be a quiz on Thursday, actually. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You would give two quizzes in the same week?
No, this is a makeup quiz.
Oh, okay, I was gonna say.
It's a makeup quiz.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Susan. Right, and the point about that is that Jennifer Lopez is so popular not because of being a good singer, but because she hits the right buttons in terms of what you mentioned, Hispanocentrism, and, you know, and the fact that she's a movie star,
right,
and everything else. But if she were, you know, 200 pounds, and so forth, it would never happen, and sang the same way.
Right.
So the point is, I mean, this is how pop works. You know, commercial success in pop has very little to do with the quality of the music.
Yeah. I guess I sort
but
of...
But I think the rap... So the part I liked was the legitimacy. You know, the fact that all these... that they get really good... they have a really good reputation among musicians. That other musicians really admire them and play on their records and so forth as a way of saying, like, you know, we dig what you're doing, then that is a sign of actually, well, it's a sign of the approval of your peers. But, you know, when you turn on MTV and see all these groups that sell millions of records who are musically non-distinguished like Jennifer Lopez, you realize it's not about the music, it's about image. It's about, you know, other cultural codes.
I think the Beasties, what surprises me about them is that everything they've done is so good. I mean, mm-hmm. not across the board, obviously, but what I mean is that that I think that there's a that a lot of their success and attention has been pretty well deserved. I mean, when they...
Yeah, but think of all those groups... Okay, but think of all those gazillion groups that don't sell records.
Right, but not... What I'm saying is not...
Are you saying they don't deserve success?
No, what I'm saying is that not everyone gets the Video Vanguard Award,
yeah.
You know, from MTV, which is I'll you know, albeit a deeply compromised source of recognition. Sure, but what I mean is that they do give airplay to people who are crap, but at the same time, they, you know, the people who sort of make it to the upper echelons of their, you know, legendary status, Madonna. You know, who they have gotten the award. Madonna, Michael Jackson, Guns N' Roses, Tom Petty, I forget, a couple other people. But, you know, these are all people who have actually been putting out quality work. It's not as though MTV wouldn't know quality if it hit them in the face. It's that they, amidst all this other garbage that they're spewing out, you know, 23 hours a day, there are people there who know what they're doing, you know, and Kurt Loder, you know, believe it or not, is actually a pretty distinguished writer in terms of some of his commentaries some of his you know, I believe that he's aware of everything that's, you know, exactly what kind of machine.
I'm sure he realizes the Total Request Live is crap.
Right.
And it's all aimed toward teenagers, and he's a middle-aged man, and I'm sure he's very embarrassed. He's like, what am I doing here?
Right.
Well, he's picking up a paycheck. He's a whore.
I disagree.
Really?
Okay. I think that he is using the news, MTV News, for his own agenda, and he is sort of the last guy kicking and screaming for quality in the corner, and he's sort of pushing everything. You know what I mean? Like
maybe that's the case. Maybe he is the last soldier who thought that MTV could actually try to push good music rather than just, you know, Britney Spears.
I mean, it's sort of like if you watch Total Request Live versus watching something, any of his special reports or any of the rockumentaries that he used to put on or anything, the amount of attention, the amount of intellectual space that's being taken up is vastly different. So I sort of feel like to say that that recognition by mainstream sources, you know, getting on the cover of Rolling Stone or Spin or whatever, you know, wouldn't necessarily be a marker of quality. At the same time, you can't get to the level that they've gotten to without you know, you can make it to the cover of Rolling Stone once. You can't make it to the cover of Rolling Stone more than once and have three different Spin covers devoted to you on the same month. You know, they did that one head on every issue thing. You don't get that without having, as they would say, the skills to pay the bills. See what I'm saying?
I disagree with that.
Really?
That's your point. I've seen Britney Spears on the cover of Rolling Stone.
More than once?
Well, she's only 17, but give her another 15 years and let's see.
I
think Shania Twain's probably been on the cover of Rolling Stone more than once, and I think she's really undistinguished.
Really? Especially even in terms of her message and agenda?
Well, no, we're talking about music.
Right, but I think that
if you talk about cultural codes and all the non-musical stuff, which is more important for pop music than music, that's another thing. But if you're trying to make an argument that the Beastie Boys are on the cover because of their music, not because of the codes around the music, that's another kind of argument. Of course, Shania Twain's on the cover, and Jennifer Lopez, because of the codes, not because of their singing.
Right, but Shania Twain, the codes are inextricable from her music, I think. I mean, you listen to her albums, and it's not... it's not very deeply entrenched. You see what I'm saying? You don't have to dig very deep and so when that's in the lyrics, you can't just say that, like, well, the music's completely different from her message, because the two are one and the same.
Well, the message is a lot of image. Okay, but what I mean is, like, what if it was a really great singer singing those songs?
Shania's Twain songs?
Yeah.
What if? I'm not following.
Well, I think my point is that... See, I went to this concert on Friday night of Myra Melford, who's a pianist, who, in my opinion, is a very distinguished pianist. There were 40 people there. She's probably 40 years old. Has put out maybe 4 records. She has played with masters, you know, Roscoe Mitchell and Henry Threadgill and all these masters of jazz music. But jazz music, of course, is a minority music. It makes 4% of American record sales. So with the exception of Wynton Marsalis and Cassandra Wilson, jazz musicians sell records in the thousands of copies. So the whole idea of commercial success in that kind of music is a very vexed thing when you compare it to the behemoth of a genre people sell records in the millions, like pop. So what that so I come in with the basic idea that music that sells lots of records, even for many, many years, is in no way related to the quality of the music. Because I think there are a lot of bands that can keep up putting out schlock for years and years and years because they have audiences that don't demand very much from them and use them as a nostalgia act or for sex symbols or whatever. And I think the case can be made that the Beastie Boys have more interest in music than a lot of schlock acts. But the fact that they're successful, like selling records in the millions, whereas Myra Melford sells records in the thousands, the fact that they're commercially successful has no relationship to their quality.
You sound so much like a Darnell sometimes. Just in terms of your cynicism about the pop machine, you know, and not being related to quality. And I, one of the things that I am, and this is perhaps a discussion for another time, but I sort of feel like I want to agree with that for the most part, but I also know that I spent a lot of time sort of being cantankerous in terms of not wanting to like anything that was pushed on me.
Right.
That I would see, you know, if it was top 40, I was not interested. Was not interested whatsoever. And
I'm not saying to be okay. I don't want to interrupt. I'm not trying to sound. I'm not really a Adorno in the sense like I think pop music is bad.
Right.
It's evil, and it's nothing but culture industry being smashed down your throat.
Uh-huh.
What I'm trying to say is that some pop music can be very, very good, but much of it, you know, like much of culture, much of high culture, much of it's junk. Because that's, you know, it's only rarely that people make really interesting stuff, because that's just how culture works, you know? That's how art works in all genres. And so the fact that the Rolling Stones can go on tour and sell out all these stadiums and put out a record that has no distinguished songs on it, and that has made no innovation and nothing. It seems clear that they're just like, you know, it's just the cash register. And who won't play in Thailand because, well, Thailand had a depression and people can't afford the tickets. And then they can't make any money there because they'd have to sell tickets for only $2. And what's the point of going to Thailand if you can only sell $2, where in New York you can sell tickets for $75 to see these codgers play? Then it makes me realize that there is no real relationship between the amount of money somebody makes over decades and the quality of the music. And also going to see, you know, jazz veterans or classical music veterans who play for an audience of 100 and who sell records in the thousands and have been doing it for decades, it makes, you know, just makes me keep in mind that album sales, you know, like ticket sales for movies, is not, in my opinion, something that tells you that something's high musical quality. It's something that says that it's highly popular, which isn't to say everything popular is bad and that I'm against Hollywood and against pop and so forth.
So aside then from recognition of peers, and
you could say, like, from the historical point of view, that it is very interesting that the Beastie Boys have gotten lots and lots of good reviews. And this is where you can, you know, you could catalog the reviews and say, this is pretty remarkable. Probably, there are probably only about 3 rap groups that have gotten reviews as good as the Beastie Boys over the course of the past 10 years. You know, like Tribe Called Quest, Brand Nubian, and somebody else. I don't know who else.
Okay.
The Roots, I don't know.
Dr. Dre.
Well, but his is shoddy because his last couple of records got, you know, 2 stars.
Right, but
that one record
anyway. And maybe Puffy.
Oh.
Although that's a whole other can of worms.
That's pop. That's not rap anymore.
Alright.
I don't want to sound like a Dorn. I'm trying to make you more historical,
right,
by saying what are the very terms that make something called successful.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I think this is good. I think you should write this. I don't want to sound negative.
Okay.
I want to be encouraging. You should write this. And there's no like red flag here at all.
Okay, and now what I'm also worried about is that is just, in all honesty, I am, this has sort of have been my priority all semester.
Yeah.
And I feel like I am devoting...
Too much.
Not too much, but just proportionally too much.
Yeah.
Especially to have a draft of a third chapter in the middle of October for... You know, for something that I have after October's over, an additional 6 months to have completed.
Okay.
It's like I'm just.
Okay. Well, do you want to then? I'm speaking fast because I know you have to go,
right.
And I want to be as conciliatory as possible because I understand what you're saying. Do you want to work then on the first 2 chapters, just like work on them for a while?
Well, see,
together we can just kind of like tweak them for a while. I always like the idea of having a big picture first,
and then
because then you'll know what, you know, because if you like. Rewrite chapter 1, you realize that you might be wasting your time vis-a-vis chapter 4.
Right.
Or do you just want to kind of talk about the books and issues and something like that?
Let me finish this chapter either for next Tuesday or the following. was that on the wall? For next Tuesday or the following, and then...
Okay.
Because I also then... The fourth chapter I had slated as sort of a history of the Beastie Boys.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how... I suppose that I could tell a story there, but I'm not sure that I would have a point or an argument. And
maybe it should be the history of their reception by critics.
Which... even there is, I mean, what I'd like to do is finish this chapter and then, I mean, if we spend all of November and December editing, rehashing, whatever, I almost like it, and I could be entirely wrong about this or overly optimistic, but I sort of feel like then I would be done with those three chapters by Christmas break, mm-hmm. and I could, and I don't know what I'm going to be doing at all next semester.
Do you have any classes?
No, I mean here with this thesis. I'm not going to be having other classes, but would it mean that, like, if I feel like if I'm working at the same pace that I do or anything near, I'm going to have edited, re-edited, rehashed, and have a pretty damn good product by...
That's my hope.
By Christmas.
But maybe it's too hard driving, huh?
Well, and then in January, does it mean that I get January through... I mean, should I plan to have January through April to have it done and, maybe tweak slightly but not work as hard? Am I working on that? Or because I sort of... That's something you and I haven't talked about.
Yeah, we haven't.
And
we can't now.
So I'm also, like, I'm afraid, like, if I'm...
Do what you... Why don't you...
If I'm
going to
be working this hard every week for the next 6 months, then I'm going to die.
Okay, well, then that's not going to happen.
Okay.
That's not going to happen, so don't worry about it.
Can we shoot to have... to sort of complete everything and then in December and then...
That's up to you. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm in favor of the idea of getting drafts of all the chapters done so that you can look at the lay of the land, so that you can actually revise with a sense of how it all hangs together.
Uh-huh.
That's my purpose.
Okay.
As far as how many times you end up revising in the spring, it's really up to you, because that's when you're really facing not, are you going to get a C or a B or whatever, because that's not in the cards, I don't think, but rather your own sense of how, much of a leap you want to make between a usual seminar paper and this as your kind of, like, most graduate school-like thing. That's kind of up to you.
Okay, because I also know that from having turned in things to you before and stuff like that I know that I could turn it in, and after five times that you would still have comments which would completely either, revitalize mm-hmm. the whole thing or things that would,
Yeah.
That it's...
I have to restrain myself. I'm trying to be inspiring, but I don't want to sound negative. I think it's really interesting, and it inspires me because I think of all these new angles, but I guess when you hear me say new angles, you think I'm saying that sometimes that the angles you have are only the beginning, that you see like an endless horizon.
Well, you understand my concern about that.
Yeah, and so I'll restrain myself. That's why I say just write as much draft as you can.
Okay.
And then we can talk on. Like I said, there's nothing in here like the folk thing that like sticks out as something that must be smashed.
And that, the problem with the folk chapter, I think, is strictly one of nomenclature. That's
nope.
One where, I was talking about functions and characteristics and whether or not I call it folk,
Right, you could go the Ollie Wilson direction, who doesn't talk it folk.
Right, and just sort of say, this is, call it what you want to.
Right.
And then...
it's an incredibly thorny topic for everybody. It's not like you're, behind the eight ball because you stumble over the idea of folk. You know what I mean? That is, everywhere, everybody. It's what makes this field... It's like a philosophical conundrum that makes this field interesting. Because it's like the unavoidable concept of that the folk authenticates music as culturally real. It's just, it's like, the black hole everybody gets sucked into.
So I want to sort of divest myself of that.
This is good stuff. You're doing great.
There was something else I was going to tell you, and I can't remember.
Did you see Apollo Kennedy last week?
No.
Yeah.
I went somewhere in Sexton and I saw somebody else. I forget. Paco Peña and Inti Illimani.
Good.
Yeah, so somebody surprised me with tickets and we had front row.
Oh.
So it was really bad because like they we thought the show started at 8.
Yeah.
And it started, or we started, it started thought at 8:30. And it was actually starting at 8.
Yeah.
And then, so we went to Pizza House for dinner beforehand, yeah, and sort of got the food at 7:30. Looked at our tickets, realized it was 8 o'clock, and we just ordered this big pitcher of Bell's, and yeah, we, you know, $12 pitcher.
What's your age?
I'm 21 now.
Okay.
So we had this.
I don't want to be harboring a fugitive.
Not at all. So we had to eat in the space of 15 minutes to then make it over to the theater, and there was no way we were going to leave without, you know, paying. We paid for $12 worth. We're going to bring it all. So the first. Come on, we paid for it. So so I was sleepy through the entire show, and which was really bad. And I sort of was, they asked us to clap, and I couldn't for life clap on rhythm, and that was a little embarrassing. But but the show was wonderful. Best good guitar players I've ever seen, ever, just in terms of straight technical ability. Okay, I'll be back in a week then.
Okay, I want to recommend a record to you.
Which one?
Michelle and the Game of Cello.
The new one?
Yeah.
Is it good? Really? Is it? I'm still going to listen to a lot of you're enjoying it? Did you buy the disc or did you?
No, I'm just playing it for you.
The voice, if it's wrong.
Crazy.
It's
crazy.
They named it Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Alright, well, I'll have more soon. And,
okay, don't kill yourself. I understand that we're moving fast. That's just, I wanted to get the idea that Maxwell's room for revisions. So that's the good news. You're seeing it's like too much deadlines for drafts.
Well,
so,
I'm also just, I think that I made a horrible decision. In terms of forward independent studies.
Yeah, that was, you know,
because I am budgeting all my own time, and it's sort of like I expand almost to time. So it's just like I need a class where they say, I don't want to be response paper to this thing once a week so that I can feel like I've got it rather than once a month I can turn in 20 papers to I got to call over to work.
Okay.
Is there
I forgot your name. Is it Emily?